Hello, my name is Hosanna Talahun, and I am at Baker Berry Library on the campus of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. I'm doing a Zoom interview with Judy Redding, class of 76, and today is Sunday, October 24th, 2021. This is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hello, JB. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, how are you? And I go by JB, not Judy.
That's good. Thank you, JB. First, I'd like to learn about your upbringing. So can you please state when and where you were born?
I was born in New Jersey, but raised in Pennsylvania. I was born in 1955.
Thank you. Can you also tell me the full names of your parents?
My father's name was Lewis Redding, Lewis L. Redding. My mother's name was Ruth Cook Redding.
All right. How do you spell Lewis?
The French way, L-O-U-I-S.
All right. Thank you. What was it like growing up in New Jersey?
I grew up in Pennsylvania. I was born in New Jersey. I grew up in a part of Pennsylvania that when we moved, and my father and mother got the house the year I was born. But when we moved in, he moved in, had a white man buy the house because he felt pretty sure that, he did the purchasing, but he sent a white lawyer friend of his to act as a representative, feeling that they probably wouldn't get the property otherwise. It was I'll say for the first 3 years of school, I was the only person of color in my classes. And by sixth grade, there were three of us. Four of color, three. My best friend was Japanese American. And who knows if we would have been best friends if the racial dynamic was not what it was, because there were many of the kids that we couldn't play with. But there also was a significant Quaker and liberal white contingent in the area. And so we also did have some friends that, you know, and homes where we were welcome, and friends that were in our classes that were not people of color, but there were definitely many who were not allowed. They might be our friends at school, but they would tell us that they were not allowed to play with us. And so it couldn't be known that we were friends. So that was an aspect of life that, you know, you're a kid and things are as they are. So it was somewhat painful, but not dominantly so. It just sort of was how things were. I think only when you'd have a harsh encounter from somebody's parents or somebody would invite you over and you wouldn't be allowed in the house, those times would be sort of difficult, but that wasn't frequent. And so day to day, you didn't think about it a lot. My parents, my mother was a physician who became a teacher. My father was an attorney, the first Black attorney in Delaware and the only Black attorney in Delaware for over 25 years. So they had very high expectations in terms of education. Probably I wouldn't have been at Dartmouth, except that I knew that I was going to be in trouble at home if I didn't go to an Ivy League school. My father went to Brown. One of my sisters went to Brown. My other sister went to Swarthmore. Brown is really our legacy school. We've got a whole lot of folks who went to Brown. And so when I was looking for colleges, I would tell Daddy I was going to Cheney or Howard just because he would snarl, because he had the expectation that we all went to Ivy League schools.
By doing my research, I realized that your father, Lewis Redding, was one of the lawyers that actually argued the Brown versus Board of Education before the U.S. Supreme Court. So how did that influence your decision to choose Dartmouth and even influence education in the household and how you thought of education?
Well, it didn't affect Dartmouth per se. You know, the Brown versus the Board of Education. We lived in Pennsylvania because my father's law practice was in Delaware and it was then a segregated state. And so he did not want his kids to grow up in a segregated state. You know, it's not far from Delaware, but he commuted to Delaware so that, you know, we would grow up in a place where we could go into any restaurant or, you know, any store without the bar of being Black. So it didn't really affect choosing Dartmouth. But that excellence in education was just a bottom line. And I bring up because Daddy had more fame, but he was quick to note that my mother was his superior in intelligence. And my mother was in the first class of Fulbright scholars. She was Phi Beta Kappa and at Hunter College. And she was a doctor of osteopathy. She became a doctor so young, she could not sit for the board. She had to wait a year because she had not reached the minimum age to sit for the boards. So had there been a little more gender equity, my mother would be perhaps even more well-known. And for a bit, Daddy apparently won the competition, but she almost married Nkrumah, the first Ghanaian president, so after independence. So I like to, and more I've started doing something in ancestry, and just really, I like to sing the female song because they often go unsung and their opportunities were so different. Even in articles I see written about my mother, and, you know, she's got quite a lot of press in her young womanhood. After it will be about one of her accomplishments, but very quickly they start talking about my uncle and my father and the men in her life. You know, rather than call her Dr. Redding, they call her Mrs. Redding. And so I point out, you know, and so she also had an expectation, but hers was less. With my father, I felt as if we didn't achieve certain things that he would be gravely disappointed in us, whereas my mother wanted us to achieve, but she also wanted us to have joy and full lives and a balance between, you know, work and life and that kind of thing.
I see. Okay. You speak of the expectation of excellence that your family held for you and your siblings. How did that impact, like, applying to college and ultimately deciding on Dartmouth?
I applied to Dartmouth really on the recommendation of a high school guidance counselor. He had seen something about the first class of women and, you know, knew me and knew of me and thought that it might be, you know, might be a good fit. And I think the summer before applications had to be completed, I drove up to Dartmouth and liked the feel of it. I'd visited Cornell as well. I had an uncle who was a professor there, and I knew he would completely cramp my style. So Cornell didn't, plus he didn't like Black people hanging with Black people. You know, he said, "You will not be part of that Black student union." And so I was thinking, wow, this will be a drag. And so but Dartmouth, I just talked to a number of students and I felt like this is a place where I might be able to thrive. I had not in any way though accounted for the climate issues, the hostility of many people to female presence and the rape culture. So, you know, as to that, you know, there's no way. I was pretty young and naive in many ways, thought that I knew more than I did, but I was completely unequipped for the violence of Dartmouth. And there were just certain things in that culture where many young innocent women in my class were harmed, yes.
Wow. Yes, we could definitely talk more about that. But in the context of 1972, you were a part of the first co-ed class that would come into Dartmouth. So there was also like building awareness about civil rights abuses overseas and at home, the Black power was also very prevalent on campus. So what was it like coming of age at this time?
Well, you know, I think you just said Black power was very prevalent on campus. I don't know that I would say that. You know, we, a couple of friends of mine and I did some things in order to highlight our perception of racism at the school. And there was the Afro-Am and the Afro-Am meetings, but, you know, and I believe it was during the years I was there that it was renamed the El Shabazz, I think they called it a temple at that point in time. You know, so there certainly was that discussion, and there was a pocket of kids who were trying to gain their knowledge in that area. That's what I'd say. I think most of us were naive. I think many of us were Black for the first time at Dartmouth, you know, that people, you'd see it at parties and so many people didn't know how to dance. I was the worst. So, you know, I won't talk about this. Some, many could dance well, but there were a lot of us who were coming out of environments where we had not been cutting edge Black power at all. And certainly among us, there were those who weren't even slightly interested in that. You know, that they were coming to college to be serious students and not get what some parents would say sidetracked with all of that. But then there were those among us that was very central to what, you know, for me, I wouldn't say it was Black power, but I would say that it was Black identity and equity and respect. Yes.
Thank you for making that clarification too. You spoke about being Black for the first time. So can you talk a little bit more about that and what that like symbolized for you and a lot of other students?
Well, you know, it's probably a little too strong a statement, but I know for myself, you know, we had a Black student union in high school, and I was involved in that. I also was part of an African dance troupe and that kind of thing. But I think that for both the politicalization and also the social effort, I think both the politics and the social effort, for some of us, we had been sheltered in such a way. I mean, a lot of the girls were raised, you know, not to go out much, not to have much social life. I can't say that I dated much at all, you know, in high school. And so we were coming, and everybody, and a lot of the socialization, or a good bit of a good number of the Black students, was a Black social life. But that didn't mean that any of us knew how to do that. Or many of us, I won't say any, there are certainly ones who knew it well, but there were quite a number of us who were trying to figure out what that was, but not be known as to try to figure out what it was. You're too young to get this, but I remember in high school, a friend asked me to go to see Kool and the Gang. And I thought I was going to meet a friend of hers named Kool, and that Kool had a gang. I had no idea that they were a group that we were going, and we lived out in the country. And so when I saw us nearing Philadelphia, I was so frightened because I thought my parents were going to do me in because we had to get home really late if we were going to Philadelphia. And then I saw them on the marquee and I said, oh my goodness, I'm glad I didn't say anything because they already don't think I'm really with it. So that's it. But I don't think I was the only one who was out of it in that regard. And we're trying to figure out what do we think about Black power at that point in time, there were several really radical political movements going on for Black folks in the United States. And actually there were, I don't know where they came from, I think Boston, but about once a month, some Black Muslims would come to the campus to try and recruit people to come to their mosque. And that kind of thing. And I think for a lot of us, we're trying to say, now, what will this look like for me? How will I express it? And what will be important to me?
Right. It's also worth mentioning that the Black community just in Hanover or Upper New Hampshire, there wasn't many Black people up there. So how did you guys build community on campus and really sustain it for students that would come in the future?
I think most, there were a few, very few, handful of Black staff and professors. And some very purposefully served as role models and almost like a certain type of familial presence. Some, I think, were not as protective as they should have been. I think some were a little bit of vultures. I will definitely not name names, but I think some things happened with some of the young co-eds, with some of the staff that just should not have happened, you know, that we were so small. But I think I know that I have a body of close friends that I formed at Dartmouth, many of whom are Black. They're not all Black, but many of whom, the majority of whom are Black, that have been lifelong bonds of friendship, and also a kind of network. And even for alums who were there in my season, who I wasn't close to, we can interact. And there's a way in which we will be there for each other just because we were on campus at the same time. So there is, you know, a sort of a foundation and a closeness, and that you see it. You see it in many of the alums that have spent a lot of their time. I'm surprised at how much of some of the alum social life is all Dartmouth. You know, mine, I can't say that's true, but certainly I've stayed in close touch with a number of folks from Dartmouth. Yeah.
So what would you say brought most kids together, most Black students together? Did you participate in any sorority events or the Afro-Am Society, which would be the Afro-American Society here? I also know that you were involved in the Black Caucus. So how early did you start getting into like advocacy, and what kind of activities were you involved in on campus?
I don't know what the Black Caucus is. So I'll just say that if I was involved in it, I didn't know that that was what I was involved in. I definitely worked on the Afro-Am. I did work on the newsletter pretty regularly. I may have at some point been an officer. I really don't remember. I was very vocal. It was after I took a class at Dartmouth on institutional racism. I was the initiator, and two friends joined with me, and we wrote a report on institutional racism. Now, that, of course, was very foundational in my community building at Dartmouth, in that we researched the report for a number of months. We interviewed a number of students. We interviewed professors. We interviewed people in the various athletic departments, did our best to summarize the information that we'd gotten, and wrote a report that was, I think, well-received, certainly well-received in the Black community, and the Black community was grateful. I think well-received in the student body as a whole, but not well-received by the administration. And it colored the rest of my life at Dartmouth. To the degree that all three of us who wrote it determined that we would get out of and graduate from Dartmouth, or at least do the things that made us eligible for graduation as soon as possible, because we felt a certain jeopardy continuing on campus after we wrote them.
To go back to the report, the Institutional Racism in Student Life at Dartmouth, your classmates that co-authored it would be Ms. Hargrove and Eileen Cave, correct?
Yes.
So how did you all meet?
We all three lived in the Choates. Are the Choates still called the Choates?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Yes, we all three lived in the Choates. They were pretty new dorms at the time. Monica lived one floor down and in a wing that, you know, that I had to pass by just to go down the stairs. And Eileen lived in one building over. And another very close friend of ours was Karen Turner. And Karen and Eileen and I, very early on in Dartmouth, you know, I have no idea what it really meant, but we were trying to form a little friendship, and we called ourselves the SSS. And so we were a little mini social group that had formed. And so we were just, you know, close friends. And then once I took the class, I came back with, you know, the key points, and we just started talking about, well, that seems to be present, you know. And for me, institutional racism, not racism as a personal animosity, but racism in terms of the structures the full systemic problem within an institution, that concept was new to me. So obviously we were in a particular institution. There was a dearth of people of color. There were issues with Native Americans. There were tiny in number, very, very, very few Native Americans at a time for an institution that was founded to educate Native Americans. And so we just thought, well, let's look at the numbers. Let's look at positions. Let's look at seniority. Let's look at that across the college framework and see what happens, because we're already very close friends. We already regularly had deep discussions. We already, you know, just had great trust for one another. And there were two guys who worked with us throughout the process, but they chose not to, they didn't write it at all, but they definitely, basically they were our sounding board. And if they thought there were flaws in our positions or, you know, some of the logic could be refined, they would work that through and talk that through with us. But they chose not to be signatories. I think they were not unwise in that choice. As I said, it did come with somewhat of a cost. Yes.
I see. Why do you think the institution had a general apathy towards the report?
It wasn't apathy, I don't think. I think apathy was definitely not a non-feeling, a lack of passion. One of the people who I interviewed, one of the deans, and I did that interview by myself, had talked with me about how Dartmouth was very happy that when other of the Ivies had sit-ins and walkouts, and unrest in and around race, Dartmouth never had, and that they did not want any light shown if there were problems in that area. And I believe that he felt some substantial I'll use the word ire. He was not thrilled by this having, not only there was the report, there was also an occasion totally peaceful, actually totally silent. We just all gathered on Baker's steps, you know, and just stood together. I believe we had a certain number of minutes of silence and thanked everybody for coming. So it wasn't, but that showing of solidarity that was visual, and there was not huge press, but some press and a write-up in the Dartmouth and that kind of thing. And I think that my personal opinion is it's true to today that Dartmouth prefers a face of great diversity, openness to, you know, Black Lives Matter, all of that. That's the face, but oftentimes the reality, the openness to Black intellectual thought, a sufficient prevalence of people of color and Black, because oftentimes Dartmouth will talk about diversity, but diversity sometimes is at the cost of Black presence, people of African descent, so that as diversity has increased, the Black presence on the faculty has dwindled. And so oftentimes the people teaching and bringing thought are not themselves of African descent or African American, and that's a different lens. And I'm not saying those other lenses should not be on campus, absolutely they should, but you should not reduce the presence of African Americans in order to increase the presence of Asians, let's say. Let's do both, not either or, but both and. And so I think they did not want a direct focus on race at Dartmouth. And so it was not apathy, it was animosity. At another point, just because if I had wanted to do anything to focus on these people, I would have done it at the time. But I will say that I received a direct threat to my well-being that was related to the Redding Report. And it was called the Redding Report at the time that we were on campus. And, someone administrative came, set an appointment with me, and it was just me and that person, and made a verbal, direct threat that I, as a young and innocent person, it nearly broke my spirit. So I know that it was not apathy. It was animosity. And it was a hostility that I never would imagine. I'm at an institution. Part of your job is to protect me, and instead you threaten me. And also, intellectual curiosity should be applauded at an institution like Dartmouth, and in many ways is. You know, I loved my education at Dartmouth. You know, I love the library. I'm a library geek, and I used to love my hours in the library, going to study one thing and then just getting lost in another section and pulling out books and wandering around in different areas of thought that I hadn't even been exposed to. And many of my classes were wonderful, but I did not feel a welcoming in terms of that particular area of exploration.
I see. Well, thank you so much for sharing, but I wanted to go back to an event you described where there was a silent protest on the steps of Baker, was it? Do you remember the date or the year?
The report came out, I believe, in November 1974. Actually, I found an original. I mean, I've had it in digital form for years and years, but I found an original just today when I was looking at stuff, trying to refresh my memory. And I know that was 74. And I know all those things happened in a relatively compact period of time. So I would imagine that it is sometime late in 74 or very early 75, but my guess would be late in 74.
Experiencing that hostility from this report and from this administrative member, how did that shape your Dartmouth experience moving on?
It made me finish in 3 years. That's the biggest way. And it made me do a lot of my last semesters off campus. When we decided to write and publish the report, the first thing we did was make sure that all three of us were academically sound, so that if an attack came, because frequently the attrition of Black male students during our time at Dartmouth was horrendous. I mean, the percentage of those who matriculated that graduated was fractional, you know, fractional. I can't quote numbers. But I sing this just phrase, it's not an answer to your question, but all of us who stayed at Dartmouth, who matriculated in our class, who were Black females, I think all of us graduated, or all but one, something like that. I mean, we made it through, and we were under a different kind of psychological attack, but there was a certain kind of, I think they looked for a certain kind of female. I do believe that our class had some strengths that were not coincidental, but also we just moved on through. We moved on through. So the attack initially affected me gravely. I felt in jeopardy. It definitely affected my mental health. But there was a professor who saw the effect. After the person came to the Choates and made the threat, And afterwards, I was so frightened that I just didn't know what to do. So I was just walking back and forth on the sidewalk between the two parts of the Choates, just back and forth. And a professor who lived at the Choates pulled me in, talked over what had happened, said, basically all that you've done will be lost if they break you. You know, and you will not have people who follow behind you and stand if they break you. But did it in such a supportive way and pretty much looked out for me. And so I can't say, therefore, it didn't have an effect. I was deeply frightened. I was deeply frightened straight through. And the same person who issued the threat was the person who handed me my diploma when I graduated. And my father and mother paid for my tuition. It was very important to them that we were not scholarship. But my father got a lot of his pay for his work in chicken dinners and pumpkin pies. And, you know, so at no point was daddy wealthy, and mom was a school teacher. So, and they had three kids in college a good bit of the time I was in college. So it was not an easy thing. So instead, everybody else had a diploma. I just had a piece of cardboard with a little note saying, when you have finished your requirements, we will give you a diploma. Now, I had finished my requirements 9 months prior to that, and everything was fully paid for. And I just today found a letter, I'd never seen it before, that my father wrote to Dartmouth. About, basically the punishment that they wreaked on him and on me by giving me cardboard instead of a diploma. Because I just walked to another building and they said, oh, oops. But the man who gave it to me, handed it to me, he winked. He was the same one who issued the threat. And when he handed me that, he winked. And I knew he didn't like me. And so I was wondering if the wink, but then when I pulled it out, and it was just, I really believe that that was my final penalty, for us writing that report.
It seems as though by publishing it, you and your classmates had to deal with all of this unnecessary, violence and hostility from administration. But did you have a professor or, besides your classmates, Monica Hargrove and Eileen Cave, besides your friend group, did you have a professor that you talked to through this? Who did you reach out to during this time?
I didn't reach out to any professor. There was that professor who reached out to me. There was another student at Dartmouth, in each situation, even for the good, I salute you and I say a peace and grace. If you ever see this, you'll know it's you. But there was a student who was very much sort of my knight, and would see when I was in any kind of trouble and would come and, encourage and talk through. And we are close friends to this day. And so that was very, very useful. And there was a professor who had stood for me before. I think she was gone by that point. Her name was Joan Smith, but I was sexually harassed my first semester. And apparently this professor who sexually harassed me was a serial harasser. The first day of class, he called me and there were two other Black women in the class. It was a sociology class. He called us. Asked us to stay after class and told us that he knew that we could not compete with the other students on the normal level, but if we were willing to work with him, we would make it through the class. And I responded to him, I'm highly offended by that. You don't know me, my capacity, and if you're going to assume I'm incapable, so I'm brown, that's highly offensive and I won't do that. Well, after that, he started regularly saying that I needed to meet with him after class. And when we'd meet, he would talk about, he'd seen me walking in my clothes, how nice such and such looked, and da 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 da. And, never about course material at all, Well, it came to a head when at some point he called me in and said, your work is an A, but in order for you to get that grade, basically he was asking for a sexual favor. But otherwise you may not pass the class. And I remember just feeling just so like, what do I do with this? You know, obviously I'm not going to have sex with the professor to get an A. He just told me I'd earned. And so the other sociology professor, Joan Smith, was in her office at the time. I took a number of classes with her that were really, really good for my future because I've done deinstitutionalization pretty much all my life. And she really laid the groundwork in terms of my being aware of how institutions have affected certain populations. But in any event, I just told her the story. I was weeping and she somehow solved it. I don't know how she solved it, but she somehow solved it. But I remember her saying, and this is so, so racialized. She said to me, oh, Judy, don't cry. If you cry, how will I be strong? And I was just like, this myth of the strong, I'm a teenager still, you know, I'm a teenager. You're a woman. And given what I just told you, crying is an appropriate response. I didn't say all this. And I just remember thinking, well, I appreciate your help, but that's sort of messed up, of course, you know, that I've got to be strong for you. No. But she really did. I don't know how she did it, but she solved that problem for me. So, but she was not there at the time. And to be quite honest with race, there wasn't really a professor I felt I could trust because the message from the dean was sent by way of a Black faculty member. So, you know, that threat, and it was a threat against my physical well-being. So I didn't know who, you know, once you have a threat from a faculty member to go to a faculty member, and I don't know, up to that point, I admired and trusted that individual. Most of us really trusted and admired that individual. I don't know what it cost him. You know, I can't imagine that was a conversation he was truly comfortable with, but there was no apology or even a look of shame when he brought this to me. So I wasn't trying to go to any faculty because I had no one that I just didn't feel safe at all. And I thank God for the professor who brought me in, because I don't know if I would have made it, what I would have done that afternoon if I'd made it through the afternoon, because that threat chilled me. But in the end, it strengthened me. By the end of Dartmouth, having been through all of that, you know, some of the eventualities of life. Life sometimes gets to be extremely full of attack. That forces will come against you. Sometimes it's some wrongdoing you do, but oftentimes it's just you and your personage. They do not accept you're at the table. They do not accept that you have a business. They do not accept you. You're in a place that they have not decided you should be in. And so that early experience at Dartmouth said, one can survive that. One can strategize to answer that. And so although it was horrendous and should not have happened, it did give me some muscles that have helped me over the course of life.
I see. Well, I apologize you had to experience all of this, especially during that time. But earlier you spoke of a culture of violence. Was it in any way perpetuated by the student body?
It was the student body. I mean, you know, I had two professor and my own assigned, we got assigned a dean to help us navigate Dartmouth. And so my dean and that professor sexually harassed me, both of them. But other than that, and neither of them laid hands on me in any way. It was verbal, but you know, whatever Joan Smith did for me with the one guy, I don't know if it would have escalated, because it was escalating at that point in time. Because first there was verbal stuff, but then a favor or a grade, that's like, you know, so I don't know what that next step would have been. But the other one, it was just verbal, but I'm going in there trying to get counsel and he's talking about what he'd like to do. And so those were the only two with faculty, all the rest was students. I don't think I want to record here any of the particulars of the rapes. It was not one, it was not two, it was not three. It would go off the fingers of one hand for sure, I believe, would get real close to the fingers of both hands. And I know that it didn't happen to every woman by any means. I've talked to a number of women from my class who it didn't happen to, but there is a woman in who recently retired from the New Hampshire legislature who was in my class who posted about her rape. And when she posted, the number of women who posted, no, Occam Pond is where it happened to me. Oh, it happened to me in that frat too. Oh no, mine was on such and such, leaned up against a tree at such and such. The number of women who responded. So I know that although they felt like such isolating experiences, two were gang rapes and frats. All the others were individual. One I was drugged. A second time I was drugged but got away. And to be quite honest, I have not yet, I've just really gotten to an age and a place of health where I can begin remembering fully. And I took a trip to Dartmouth and that began the season of, oh, I would pass corners and say, oh my goodness, it was like flashback city. But for me, not only am I okay, I don't know if you know I'm a preacher, but I'm a preacher, but it has allowed me to be a different kind of prophetess in that I know being able now, I can tell my story. I can sit down one-on-one, break it down if it's needed, or just, I can talk about this. It's not with, you know, I can't say there's no pain because of course that's costly. It's costly to your intimacy in relationships you choose. It's costly to your sense of value. It's costly to just how you move through the world and trust and all of those things. But I'm okay. But having seen when she reported, and then there was another woman, but I think she was a class behind us, who also posted, which I think she was in the Washington Post, and she told her rape story. So it was, and I believe is, a prevalent issue at Dartmouth that Dartmouth has not, they had a big commission on rape, but they haven't, they want to sit down and say we're fixed too early, you know? But we still have the highest stats in the Ivy League. And when, because I volunteered to be part of that, you know, rape culture discussion and commission, but they would not let me participate. And I mean, they kept acting like they couldn't see my emails and whatever that was. And then by the time they did respond, they said, oh, we're all finished. We've taken care of it. And the reason we have higher numbers than anybody else is because people feel so safe to report at Dartmouth. That said, oh my goodness, you know, that's not what that means. That's not what that means. And if it does, but you've got the highest numbers, you got to do something about those numbers, you know, because those are lives. Those are young lives impacted harshly at a point when they're just forming their polishing off their new sense of adult ego, sexuality, self-concept. It's gotta be solved. Yeah. So,
right. I mean, sexual violence prevention at Dartmouth is still a big thing. And thank you for sharing your story and being so vocal about it, because it definitely contextualizes our history here and the work that they're trying to do at this campus for us. And I really resonated with how you said visually Dartmouth likes to show how everyone is doing okay, is working harmoniously. But it's really important to bring up these instances where they didn't and kind of uncover this culture of harassment or this culture of just being ignorant to other people's struggles. And I wanted to ask you, what were some ways that you found safety or And what activities did you partake in that you felt joy after?
Well, to be quite honest, I'm a vagabond girl. I mean, even to this day in my 60s, I'm a vagabond. You know, I roll here, roll there, check on this, check on that. I'm an adventurer and all the rest. And so I can't say that I had all these experiences, and I know people for whom they say abuse, rape, attack stops their show for years. But with me, it was like, okay, this is horrible. You know, I'm in this, oh my goodness, what? Because in a couple of minutes, it's like, I don't know what happened, but I knew something happened. I knew it was sexual. You know, as I say, I woke up one morning, couldn't remember the night before, but was sticky, just covered in sticky, naked and sticky, and had lost the whole night before. And I wasn't doing drugs. I'm sure I would slip some drugs, but I was not doing drugs. So it was horrible. And certainly for a day or two, I never told anybody the whole time I was at Dartmouth about that night. It was way after Dartmouth I ever told about that, because I couldn't tell you anything anyway. I mean, clearly I'd been raped, but who or whatever, because I lost the night like an hour into a party that I'd thrown with two of my friends. That night ended in my mind. And then I woke up sticky. But I didn't move around. It didn't then change. First of all, I had to get my books. I had to get my papers in. I had to do my thing. And so it was sort of like you had to, okay, get it together. You've got work to do. And I didn't then wander around. I'm always afraid. You know, that was not who I was at all. I was rolling, you know, I was doing what I did and, you know, checking this out and hanging with my friends and that kind of thing. And these events happen. Certainly they weren't happening every day. Certainly they weren't happening every month, but they're so impactful. They're both impactful and secret. Not because they're private, but I don't know. I still haven't gotten to the point where I know how to integrate them. I know I shouldn't feel shame, but that doesn't mean I don't feel shame. And rape victims will tell you, and I can say it's certainly my testimony, that at least half of the time, if you dare to tell, somebody says, what did you have on? Well, where were you? Well, do you think you could have given a signal? You know, and it's like, yeah, I said, please rip off my clothes, leave bruises on my body, you know, and take something I told you you couldn't have. Yes, that was, I gave that indication. But I didn't feel unsafe as I moved through Dartmouth. The only time I felt unsafe was after that threat from the administration. Yeah, then I felt unsafe for the rest of my time there. I was, you know, someplace I was always like, it was sort of like this. It wasn't like I thought somebody was going to jump me. It was more like, did they really feel they could say that to me? Wow, who are these? Where am I? That's really how I felt, that kind of unsafety. But the knight in shining armor told me, just don't ever go on frat row. You are not safe there, you know? And, you know, just that kind of thing. But the both frat rows, I was drugged and taken to frat row both times. So it wasn't as if I said, oh, let me party on frat row, but so I felt safe most of the time. I felt safe and I had friends and I enjoyed them and, you know, I pretty much did what I wanted to do. And I think that might have made me more vulnerable in that I went where I wanted to go. And I've never been one to run with a pack, you know. I run with myself a lot of times. I mean, I might have friends with me, but I don't need to gather three girls to move. That's just not who I am. I was just, you know, I just go, what do I want to do? Let me go do that, you know? And so I think that may have given me a little jeopardy because I might have been accessible in ways that some of my friends were not.
Right. I also want to ask, did it take you a lot of time to open up about the verbal attack from the higher ups? Because I do remember you spoke of a letter that your father wrote to the institution.
But my father did not, in the letter or in any conversation we had, although we didn't have much conversation, I've seen my father cry twice in life. Once was when his brother died. He didn't break down at my graduation, but his eyes surely filled with tears when he heard that I didn't have a diploma. And surely it was financial, but you know, my father went to Brown, and a good bit of the time he was on campus, he was the only Black person on campus. They put a ring of chairs around his desk so nobody would have to sit beside somebody Black. You know, it was the early 1900s he was at Brown. He still was a commencement speaker. He was a man who had a kind of, I guess both of my parents did, but the story's told more about my father, so I know his struggles more. And he was still a commencement speaker. He was dogged in getting, in achieving, in focus. You know, that's just who he was, but it cost him quite a bit, you know. And then he went on to Harvard Law School, and again, he wasn't among plenty, but I didn't hear it being quite so brutal in terms of his study situations. He couldn't live in the dorms because Blacks couldn't live in the dorms at Brown. So he had lived an isolated life, and then wanted his children to go to Ivy League schools. And I never asked him why that was so important to him, but it was of great importance to him. And it took all they had financially. Not that, you know, I don't want to tell the story wrong. Nobody went into poorhouse. Nobody went into great debt. But it was everything to get their kids through school. And with all of us, they did not want us an undergraduate, because at that point, everybody was saying, we were inferior, there was special treatment, so he wanted us to get in by our grades and go through in his pocket, you know. And so those tears, you know, but I don't know that he associated it with the Redding Report. I mean, he knew I'd done the Redding Report. I didn't tell my father about the threat. You know, I knew how much it was for me to be there and what's and all of that. And I didn't want him to have the fear, you know, and I didn't want, I've told him, he had a completely sanitized version of my time. He didn't know ever that I got raped at Dartmouth. I did manage to get a car out of him when I first went up there, because I said, you know, you can't have to have me depending on a man to get in his car each time. And I did manage to get a car out of him, but he didn't know what did happen to me, you know. And so I don't know that he associated the two, but I strongly associated with the man giving me the wink. And then I pulled out cardboard when everybody else was showing their diploma. You know, one thing I did learn though, and this wasn't race. This was just, human interaction. Now I call it people will do anything. But at that point, it's like Pollyanna has to get some wisdom. You know, in my faith, we say, wise as a serpent, gentle as a dove. You know, I don't much like snakes, but there comes a time when you have to face that they may use snakes on you, and you've got to be prepared. And that was that threat, and then that wink, and the diploma and all that, that I was still a child even when they handed me the diploma. And that at that point, that you're gonna take out that for, I don't think there was much in the report that was damning other than truth. You know, there was no acidity in that report. But that you would attack a teenager on the basis of a class that you offer, you know, and a lot of us doing it was our nerdishness. They say, well, let's work this out. Let's apply this to the institution where we are, you know. And then I surely wasn't expecting a threat. You know, I had never considered that. I'm sure my father wouldn't have been surprised by it. He had more death threats when he was, you know, the only attorney and only Black attorney doing things for civil rights issues and people who had never had a defense of their contract and not letting people steal their land and all of that. I know my father knew there were consequences, but I didn't want to frighten him. You know, I didn't want to frighten him. So neither of my parents ever heard about the rapes. Neither of my parents ever heard about the threat to my life. In fact, I didn't tell anybody, including to the two sisters who wrote the report, until maybe 2 years ago. It was the first I told them.
Well, again, I'd like to say thank you for sharing this. I mean, this is the time to do it. Earlier, you spoke of the naivety that a lot of co-ed students or a lot of the women that were part of the co-ed class had. Do you feel like collectively you were able to mature after knowing of these experiences, like these harassment experiences on campus, or was it more of an individual change or realization that Dartmouth wasn't as perfect as they like to advertise?
Well, you know, I don't think it's all really just Dartmouth. I mean, you know, I've said some specific things. I think the one thing that I think is Dartmouth that we need to continue to contend with is that rape culture. You know, I really think, and I think that there are groups that are working hard on racism. I think this course is a byproduct of it, quite honestly. And so I hope that there's a genuine effort that continues on race as well. But I think the naivete is in part just what age we were, you know, and then an age where we were crossing a continental divide. This had been a male school. And when you have single sex schools, there's certain things that can be part of the culture that are, we'll say, on the DL, that by women coming, they fracture the DL part of the culture. Somebody's admitting that that's part of the culture, then it gets fractured without repair. There were no rainbows at that time. The word gay did not exist. Gay meant I'm happy and free. You know, that's what gay meant at that point in time. And so for people who were attracted to a single-sex school so they could explore the possibility of their homosexuality or the knowledge of their homosexuality in a place, and then it's remote. It's Dartmouth, all up in the woods of, you know, New Hampshire, you know. We cracked into some stuff with no knowledge of what we were cracking, even when we were in the midst of the cracking going on. And so some of the things we experienced were also a byproduct of being the first class of women. They often called us cohogs. That was Black and white, not co-eds, but cohogs. They would tell us that we were meat relief stations, you know, that they just sent women so that they could have access to a little this and that. But a lot of that was just, they were immature too. And some of them naive too. But in a culture where you have naive males and they say boys will be boys, so they're allowed to break and destroy things and just carry on because boys will be boys. But if you're some of the breakage, you know, so we mature. Because it was the years of life when you're maturing and, you know, trying to figure out how you'll use your sexuality, what consent looks like, and here when people, it's before no means no. And so all of us had to mature, but the things each of us encountered was a little different. You know, those of us who hadn't been exposed to homosexuality at all and, you know, find out that your boyfriend is also sleeping with your best friend's boyfriend. Well, that causes you to mature. You know, causes you to think, you know, it causes you probably to shed a few tears. But, you know, so there was a lot going on, but some of that was just age and life and being the first class of women.
I see. I'd also like to talk about the open letter to the Black community that you also authored with your classmates. I noticed you quoted the song Stand by Sly and the Family Stone to give thanks to the Black solidarity on campus. So how important was music to campus life?
I think
So, you know, this continues to this day. I hear tell when, you know, you'll have a campus gathering place or the place where everybody eats, and a lot of Black students sit together. And there'll be, why do you always sit together, kinds of things. You know, that was definitely an issue, or at least I don't think it really was a problem. I think the Black students sat together not just by Black student preference. I think everybody was really cool with it. But when racism would come up, people said, well, you guys always sit together. But I think both the islands in the cafeteria and the parties periodically at the AM, those were like bomb. There were a situation where, because you're very right to be in a class, often got questioned. You took a slot from, I said, I took a slot from my slot. You know, what do you have that I don't have? Compete with me directly and let's figure out what I took. But I came from a background where I could just, I knew that to be true. I belong here. Stop your nonsense, you know. But for many folks, it might be
the first generation in college. And so you don't have that same assuredness, you know, to come back. And so I think for a lot, those
parties and the music and all the rest, especially
songs like Stan, you know, allowed you to have the strength to go back out in what was geographically a very white environment. And oftentimes there was just kickback just for you being you. You know, just you're trying to walk in your own reality. You're not really trying to be anything. And then people are trying to push back on your right to even exist. You know, And the presumption of stupidity. Oh, you know, so you could be. And for me,
oh my goodness, I love Dartmouth, both white and Black communities, but it was a different thing in being able to brush it up against that almost everybody in your class, you could sharpen yourself by their minds. I love that about Dartmouth, you know. You know, it was a nice place to be the smart kid in the class. That's a nice, you know, a nice little island to be in high school. But it is sweet when you can think together, when you can reason together, and it's like, whoa, I can't keep up with him. Wow, I didn't know that. You know, that was very, very sweet. But in the Black community, you'd also run into people who were thinking
thoughts you'd never heard in terms of Black community,
in terms of politics, in terms of the diaspora, you know,
that you just hadn't been exposed to. And so it would stretch you out and make you say, you know, that's a possibility. We had, two men from Africa in, one was, I think, a class above, and one was in our class, Kwame Ofiori Kwakye, I think his name was. So I'm pretty sure he was Ghanaian. Bimas Tal, I didn't know as well, but just that exposure and thinking just broadened your thinking. So some of it was music, but some of it was just that shoring up of your sense of self for being in a community that did not deny your intelligence and even right to be at Dartmouth just because of how you look.
Right. So continuing on like that diversity, were you involved in any off-campus programs like trips to Sierra Leone or Jersey City?
I went to DC, government program. Did I go someplace else? I'm thinking I did, but I might be confusing it with seminary many years later. Let me think. I really think I did two semesters off campus, but the only one that's coming to me is DC. So maybe that was it. I did not go overseas when I was starting. Most of my friends did, but
for the government program, what kind of things were you involved in?
I worked in the Office of Criminal Justice. I can't remember the last word in the title of that, but they gathered stats on criminal justice issues from you know, age of offenders, recidivism, what communities were most affected, which crimes, that kind of thing, and analyze them. And they also just gave me a real good exposure to all the interlocking criminal justice agencies, because in DC, you know, you got the national government and all those different branches of criminal justice, as well as, you know, the metropolitan area. So that's what I did there.
So you talked about being interested in institutional change during your time at Dartmouth. So what kind of classes were you attracted to, and did you do any research at your time here?
Well, the class that I was referring to, and I don't know, sociology, something. But and this is, you know, a long time ago, remembering the specifics of this class, but I know that it talked about institutionalization and then looked at it in terms of sectors of the society. So that included institutions. At that point, I called them barns of humanity. I don't think anybody else calls them, but that's what I encountered. But at that point, if you had mental illness, mental retardation, or your family decided to put you away, everybody went to the same place. And then if you were a kid with what now is called a status offender, but a kid who maybe missed too much school or maybe just couldn't get along at home, you know, minor delinquency, as they call it, they might end up in there too. So they just throw all these people in the same place, inadequate staff and that kind of thing. But she had a study who was there, you know, who was there, and then who was in prison. And those, that was my first exposure to the percentage of America that gets put away and is not free to go. The percentage that gets put away that have done nothing wrong, and the percentage that are brown and black. That was my first exposure to that. And I didn't know that it would impact my future so much. But, you know, as a preacher, I've pretty much done most of my work outside of the church. Until coronavirus, I regularly preached in a prison in Maryland, you know, and ministered there. And I've done a lot of my ministry in Uganda. And then my life's work is caring for folks with disabilities. So in three different states, I've been involved with deinstitutionalization and, you know, caring for people who then are living in the community. And she gave me a fabric for it. And right now I'm doing volunteer work in one community. I've done it in a couple, but in terms of police justice. But that fabric of, when you look at that fabric, the lack of fairness, and it sort of colored the way I looked at a lot of things, because those demographics say there is no justice. The demographics, when you study that, and that was my first exposure to those stark demographics, which have gotten considerably worse over in the decades since I studied them at Dartmouth. Yes.
Right. Just going off of that lack of fairness, I do remember you were speaking about the housing discrimination that your family faced when you were younger. So I wanted to ask, whenever you imagined your college experience, specifically the academic part of it, did you know that you would go towards what you're working now?
No, absolutely not. I was probably 10, 11 when I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And I think that was largely because I knew Daddy did good things for people. You know, he impacted lives and he helped people who couldn't afford his help regularly. And that's what attracted me, you know, long before I identified it as God, long before I thought about it in terms of justice or helping, I was crafted to, you know, that really my goal in life is to be a blessing, you know, But then as I've aged and put my hands to things, I've tried to figure out, given my own capacity, which I'm very, very, very aware of my limitations, but given my own capacity, how can I be a blessing multiplier? That how can I be a fulcrum of blessings? You know, that if people can be blessed by what my hands can do, well, that's just a scattering. So is there a way in which I can scatter to scatterers? You know, that I can focus in that way. And I've got a small mission project by which I do the prison ministry, but in the Africa ministry is most of it, is called Today's Seed, Tomorrow's Hope. And that's that same multiplication principle, that we raise a bunch of babies, but we make the babies promise that they'll bless a bunch of babies that are not out of their own wombs or out of their own seed. And so that, you know, the seeds will continue to multiply. But that, I think that's all been a byproduct of that. You have a social problem, you don't bring people in and lock them up and kill their spirits and make them more violent. No, that's not the process. That's not the way. And you don't decide that certain people in your society will be locked up so that they can make other people wealthy by locking them up. That people shouldn't be becoming billionaires off the bodies you've locked up. You know, now we've switched it from these weren't reflected in her demographics at all, but now we've switched it to the immigrant population, and people are getting rich off the institutionalization, you know, but the scars of when you get too many people in any one building, horrors will happen. The people who run the buildings lose their humanity. When people become numbers, danger ensues and you crack open souls. And sometimes when you institutionalize people for too long, it's almost impossible to put Humpty Dumpty together again. They just get too broke.
Yeah, those are great points. I do recall in the 70s, Dartmouth was getting a lot of backlash for recruiting military or ROTC on campus. Were you aware of any of the protests that happened at that time relating to the military and divesting from the military?
Only to one degree, not real specifically. So when the Reading Report was disseminated, we had that a little protest on Baker, odd groups of people would come to my dorm room and try and get me to be a speaker for their project. You know, that apparently maybe because my name was attached to the report, and for Dartmouth in our era, that was a really big thing because people hadn't cried out publicly for quite some time. And so, you know, that they tamped those words down. They just didn't let those go public. So, and so they wanted to use me. And it happened, I think there are three different, one individual and two different groups. One individual tried to convince me to be, I don't know if you'll know this name, but I think her name was Tawana Brawley. Basically say somebody did something to you that didn't, so that we can get notoriety for our cause. And then an organization, a communist organization, wanted me to be their front person. And that was the one that had to do with the divesting, and the Communist Party wanted to do something. So that's where I got exposed to it. But it's just like, yeah, but I'm not a communist. And that's not what I was trying to do. I'm thinking not. I'm thinking they already want to kill me.
So after institutional racism in student life at Dartmouth was disseminated, your name was obviously attached to it since it was called the Reading Report. So were students very aware of your work and what you stood for on campus because your name was attached to it?
To be quite honest, I can't remember exactly. I think I may have been the most vocal and the more, yeah, I think I may have been the most vocal. And I went to the class. So they were like collaterally inspired, they definitely did at least as much work, you know, certainly as their thinking and contribution and interviewing was not less than mine by any means. But I'm not quite sure how, but I think that I was more vocal. I was definitely probably more strident. Monica, to this day, Monica's got such a fine mind. I love Monica's mind. And she's passionate, but she is never strident. I am often strident. And I don't cloak what I have to say like at all. You know, I don't have that gear. You know, the times when I wish I had after I said it. I thought that 3 or 4 times in this interview, like, JV, that was too much. But Monica is I won't say veiled, but she's just, she lays it out, she's bold, but she's never strident. And Cave was more interacting person to person. Cave was going, Eileen Cave, I call her Cave. She was going person to person and advocating and telling the story. And so somehow that happened. But you know, you are yourself. I remember being surprised when people kept knocking on my dorm room. So I don't know whether it was because of the Ready Report or because I was out there in a way, you know, that the others weren't. I don't really know. But, you know, I think I was pretty well known on campus anyway. You know, I was on a number of committees, you know, that had nothing to do at all with political justice, just committee on student life and da da da. You know, I was involved in campus life in ways where I thought I could be effective. So, you know, and I had a lot of friends in a lot of different places.
It's good to hear.
Product of being a vagabond. Yeah.
Oh, right. In what ways did you contribute to campus life? Were you organizing events for the student body? In what ways were you involved?
No, it wasn't so much that. It was just, and I can't remember. I think at the point when I was on the most committee, I think at some point I was on 3 different committees. I remember the committee on student life. I don't remember much 50 years ago exactly what we did, but I know I was not organizing events. That's not one of my skill sets. So I don't think I was doing that. But I know that we looked at, we didn't call it that, but a campus atmosphere, you know, just, you know, does everybody have the room to live well and freely? We also looked at campus discipline because there was an inequity then, and I have been with the CBAD enough to know that there's inequity now in terms of who is prosecuted for what kinds of things on campus. And so we looked at that kind of thing, the composition of the committees that would be triers, if you will, of the people who came, you know, up for campus discipline. I remember those things. But I'm almost sure there was another committee that wasn't like that at all, but I can't remember what it was. I was in the marching band, but I had no skills. So I had a girlfriend, Karen Turner. I would call out your name, Karen Marie Turner. She was in the same class. And so she, it was her impetus that got me in 3 things that I would have very unlikely to have been on otherwise, but they did, it definitely all gave me joy. We were managers of the boys basketball team. And it's just because we were first class of women and they couldn't figure out how to say no to us. They really wanted to, but Karen would talk very quickly about how freedom and we should be given opportunities and da 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 da. Next thing you know, we were managers of the boys basketball team. We were the first Dartmouth cheerleaders, and we turned out to be an all-black squad the first time. And what was the third thing? We were in the marching band, and neither of us could play an instrument, so she played the, and I played the maracas, they called it tambourine, but it got us to all the football games, so she managed to get us to all the football games and all the basketball games with her creative self. So that was another way I was involved.
So how would you say these extracurriculars shaped your Dartmouth experience for the better or worse? Like, was there, just this story sounds like very joyous as well. So was that a highlight of your Dartmouth experience?
It was definitely fun. It was definitely fun. And you know, My mother never would allow us to be cheerleaders. She felt very strongly that we were never to be side dressing. We were always to be part of the main event. So she would just, you couldn't even get the word cheer out of your mouth before she would prohibit anything like that. And I got exposure to both the manager of the basketball team and following the teams around. I got exposure to athletic life in a way I wouldn't have otherwise, and which was new to me. And that was sort of fun. They really have not done much of anything in shaping my life going forward, except for some friends I made on the teams that continue to be friends. Yes.
Your proximity to the athletic team help when you guys were researching for the report on institutional racism in student life at Dartmouth?
Absolutely. Now, Eileen Cave did the most of the interviewing for the athletic part. She
had her own reason to have exposure to the football team. And so, you know,
she'd heard a lot of the discussions that the guys were having about fairness and what positions Black guys weren't allowed to play and da 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 da. So she volunteered to do that. But certainly by being managers of basketball team, we also had been exposed to some stuff, and we kept all the stats and that kind of thing, so we had some idea of some of those issues. And then you rode on the bus, so you heard what the guys were saying
and you know, what seemed to be fair or unfair to them, that kind of thing. And I wouldn't have been equipped to even think about those things had we not had those experiences.
Right. So after earning your bachelor's at Dartmouth, why initially did you want to go into law, and how did that shape your interest in pursuing divinity too?
Well, law school, okay.
I finished in 3 years at Dartmouth. I just had to get out of there. And when I had a year at home before I started law school, because I graduated with my class, sort of. But anyway, so when I went home, I was aware that I had a hole in the middle of me that needed to be filled. And I figured it was God. I just didn't know what God that would be. And so I spent a lot of that year getting an answer to that question. And so by the time I graduated, I had come to a belief in Jesus Christ.
And, you know, I'd been raised in the church and da 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 da. I certainly had interacted with them, probably employed by God all my life, but I would not have said that a God in Jesus Christ
was the light and the power and the unction of my life prior to that point in time. And so that happened. You know, spent a whole lot of that year in church, came back, but I had wanted to be a lawyer just because I think I just wanted to be like my daddy. My daddy wanted a boy real bad. I was the last one, so I tried my best to be my father's boy. And so but I didn't like law school like at all. You know, I liked some of the thinking, but I didn't like law school. I didn't like the process. It seemed to be unnecessarily harsh, and I just didn't like law school. And so before I finished law school, I wrote to my father and said, you know, I'm not going to practice law. You know, just that's not going to happen. But it was years of angst, because I really believe he kept his law practice open for some years waiting for me to change my mind. You know, but I didn't go to seminary till I had just finished my first year of seminary on September 11th. So, you know, I was well into mature womanhood by the time I went to seminary. And, you know, as a believer, I was very active. I was not yet a missionary, but I was quite content with being what I was, the person who went to church and sometimes taught Sunday school. That was plenty, you know, and I gave a little money here, gave a little money there, da 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 da. I thought I was, you know, doing my thing good enough, you know. And it was very central to my life
but I wasn't even slightly interested in a position in the church, which is probably good because I still don't have a position in the church. but at some point, I experienced a call on my life. And so I went to seminary after a little resistance to it. But an old lady in my life, who's the mother of a Dartmouth friend, basically read me the riot act and chased me to seminary. So.
And that was my best educational experience of all. Seminary was just sweet. Yes. So that's that. But most of what I've done with it, as I told you, is, you know, trying to bring a few different kinds of bread to folk in Africa. And I have an international Christian community that I'm a part of, because the seminary I went to Japan to a missionary community that includes people from the whole world. So, yeah.
So at Dartmouth, were you involved in religious life?
A little bit. We had a preacher named, I think his first name was Floyd. I don't remember his last name. And nearly every Sunday, he would say, "I'm not interested in pie in the sky. I want meat in the streets." So that was his primary theology. That he wanted justice now. Forget about heaven. I think that's pretty much what his pie in the sky, meat in the streets thing meant. And we had a little gospel choir, and I was in it. So was Monica. So was Kate. And, you know, I'll frankly say that for me, I spent most of my life in an Episcopalian church that for many, many years, we were the only Black family in it. And so that's a big part of my Christian roots, because you sort of are what you were, you know, to a certain degree. But I've been AME since I was a teenager. And I didn't come from any great preaching tradition. That's my point there. I can't say I sat under any great preachers in my whole childhood. That just wasn't true. They were okay. They're nice people. But there was no, like, "Oh, that changed my life" kind of preaching going on. That was what I experienced. But the preaching at Dartmouth for me just didn't do it. It didn't call me to action. It didn't call me to God. I don't mind political in the midst. But I need God to be, for me, I want to hear what's God got to do with
this politics, you know? And I didn't experience that. So I can't say I liked being in the choir. I enjoyed that. But it wasn't really so religious. And that might be why I went seeking as soon as I left Dartmouth. Because I had this, I mean, it was concrete. It was part of what I was going to do with this year, a big part of it. I was going to figure out, I knew it was God. Who is God? That's, you know, so I did a lot of reading and studying different religions, you know, and then just sort of laid open and said, "Show up, God, you know, I'm ready, show up, you know." And so that was my participation. I don't know that I was there every Sunday all the years, but I know most of the time I was at Dartmouth, I think I participated in chapel.
It also sounds like you grew your religion after Dartmouth. So once you graduated, was it kind of a progression towards that state? Or did you always know that you wanted to take a break from Dartmouth and focus on kind of giving yourself the time to discover Christ on your own?
Well, I don't think they had so much to do with each other. You know, yes, I used that year to find God for myself, but I don't know that I would have finished Dartmouth in 3 years had I not been part of the Reading Report and been threatened. Well, once I was threatened, I mean, we would talk about it. We just need to get out of here as soon as possible. We need to be safe, you know, and, you know, we need them not to come after us. We need them, you know. We don't want, you know, we want to end up with a good college degree. You know, we've done all this. We did that little report for a couple of months, but this is getting dicey. And so since I had the year, that's where it fell. Now, would it have fallen that year if I'd been at Dartmouth? God knoweth, I don't know, you know. But long before I thought about and wasn't even considering, I think very young, I probably did get a call in my life to preach, but I was more interested in playing. And I remember thinking about it like, I don't think I can do both. I want to play, you know, but it wasn't something that nagged me through my adulthood. But I think there was a point in which there was sort of that tug and I didn't answer. But a lot of my adult life, by the time I came back from Japan, I lived in Japan for 3 years. By the time I came back from Japan, the hunger to know God's word, that just, there was a new seriousness on me where I just would sit down and start reading and then studying and trying to find out the meaning and, you know, be digging in three or four different things. And my sister, for many years was an Episcopalian priest. She can read, I think she's fluent in Hebrew, Greek and Arabic. So if I got stuck, I'd call, Holmes, what does this really say? What's it say in the original language, you know? And seminary was a great tool to, I'll never touch her, I don't think, in her fluency, but I have the ability to do some of that digging myself now. Yeah, so it's grown, but I think also it has more integrity. In other words, my faith and what I believe about justice, what I believe about God, how I plant my garden, they all relate more. As I get older, that's what integrity really means to me at this stage in life, is that my life is integrated in a way that it's all a whole cloth.
Okay, so earlier you spoke of an urgency to graduate after the report was published. Was that difficult to accomplish?
No, because Dartmouth right then had, I don't remember, but they had this semester program where you could sort of smash them all together, do very little summer, and smash them all together and get out of there. It was very easy to get out in 3 years in one semester.
Was it also easier because you had classmates that were also interested in getting out too?
I don't think so. You know, some of my girlfriends, when they left Dartmouth, they moved to the same city and you know, and just sort of rolled together for a while. And something was very clear to me that I needed to not do that, that I needed to face the fact that it was time for me to figure out what my life was supposed to look like and what. And I didn't yet have this language. This is what I call it now. What God would have for me to do. But that even by that point, it was, I don't just make decisions. There are decisions that are made that I need to walk into. And that if I go to the city where my girlfriends are, we'll be playing all the time. And that it's time for me to be purposeful, that I was created for a purpose. I need to comprehend what that is and walk in that purpose. Now, I certainly can't say to you that I stopped playing. That would be a gross and horrible lie, and lightning would fly from the sky and knock me out. I played for a long time in life, still play a little bit. but I have been very goal-oriented, but not so much on what I will achieve as doing that which I was sent to do.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, and for participating in this interview. So yeah, we can end it right here if you have nothing else to say.
No, I think I want to say one thing. It happens certainly currently in our national politic, but I think it happens often when someone like me is free to speak a critique, that people will then call us haters. But Dartmouth working with CBED made me realize that I do have a strong love of Dartmouth and that there is a framework that Dartmouth gave me for intellectual thought, for study, and for being willing to stand when you have not been invited to stand, but that you need to stand because something needs to be said, but you also need to stand to give others the courage to stand. And my Dartmouth experience began that for me, but I don't say that it's Dartmouth that threatened me. A particular person thought that they would, and I would say, abuse their power in a way to threaten me, to deny me my timely diploma, to punish me for free speech and intellectual inquiry. But it was a place that offered the institutional racism course. And so I think Dartmouth has a, at least the years I've known Dartmouth, it has this struggle. It's this struggle where it really wants to include the whole world and hear from the whole world. But then when it hears from the world that used to serve the table, that used to be colonial subjects, used to be the darker continent, used to be all of that. And that world in its brilliance shines a light that Dartmouth is uncomfortable with. Then for a while, they want to kick all of those few voices out for a while. And then they struggle because there is a genuine intellectual curiosity and academic rigor at Dartmouth. And so then the people are back. And then they, you know, so I see that struggle at Dartmouth. And so I am trying to get my strength up once I finish wrapping up my business to continue to encourage Dartmouth and its better angels to continue to hear all the voices, even those that challenge them or that they are not so used to having as equals at the table. So, you know, I have critique, but I think if your family's got issues, you got to critique them so you can improve. And a lot of this critique is out of a love. The only part of it that's beyond love, it's just common decency, is we have got to stop the violence towards one another and the turning of the head up towards it in certain instances. We just, it can't be okay for certain people to be violent because they're stars of this or important to that. The violence has to stop. And in that area, it's beyond critique. It's just an absolute need that Dartmouth faced that. And, you know, we got to end that violence. We just have to end that violence or greatly reduce it. We're human beings. There will always be some violence. But we really, the we can't have a quiet tolerance to certain violence.
That is really important to address. And I'm happy that you were able to amplify your message during this interview. Once more, thank you so much for your participation and have a good rest of your day, JB.
All right. Good meeting you.
Good meeting you as well.